radial vent pipe. Is that possibly true, Aaron? WC2C, K2RIW on the TechNet?
Of course. Yeah, I didn't think of that. I was thinking of, like, electrical conduit and duct work, whatever. But that's the 4-inch stack that comes out, that's connected to the sewers, that comes out, you know, on the roof. There's about 4 feet of that pipe, which extends vertically from the base of the roof, and all my antenna stuff is attached to that pipe. And, you know, like, it's pretty sturdy. And so far, with all the crazy weather we've been having over the years, I'm glad to say that everything is intact.
Yeah, let me get a little bit more of a feeling now mechanically. That vent pipe that you're connected to on the roof of your building, is that roughly 2 stories or 3 stories above the street, Aaron? Go ahead.
Yes, there's a street floor, then there's a second floor, then there's a third floor, then there's the roof.
Okay, I've got a little bit more of a picture of what you're doing. It is my belief, Aaron, that 80% of your counterpoise, electronically speaking, is that vent pipe, that 4-inch diameter vent pipe. And the counterpoise wire that you hung across the roof is belt and suspenders. If you did an experiment someday and disconnected your zip cord counterpoise, I think you would get 95% of the same performance out of that antenna. Whether or not you do that is your choice as to whether or not you want to be a scientist. But I think your real counterpoise, which is something good to know, because other people have a vent pipe and maybe they have access to it. You see where I'm going on this one, Aaron? WC2C, K2RIW.
Exactly, yeah, that very well may be, because that vent pipe extends all the way down to the basement, goes underground, and is connected somewhere down the street into the sewer.
So, Mel, as you can see, there are hidden, beautiful counterpoises in many of the buildings that we live in that we don't know about. That steel vent pipe, unfortunately, an awful lot of modern buildings are starting to use PVC, and we're going to lose that. But on the slightly older buildings that have a steel vent pipe, that's one hell of a counterpoise for HF frequencies. I bet you heard stories along these lines, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yes, that's for sure. Yeah, well, I would suggest also, which is a number of people I've talked to, you know, being on, getting on 80 meters quite a bit for many, many, many years. Go back, 58 years. I started on 80 and pull on 80. But I had a lot of success with an antenna called the inverted L. And the flat top I used on my inverted L was at that time, where I lived at that time, what did I have about, I guess about, about 60 feet of flat top. Then I dropped it down, was also in a tree, and it was camouflaged because there were trees by the, where I lived, always, you know, on the street. So ran the wire really through the trees and managed to slingshot it up at that time. 60 feet, dropped the wire down into the garden, the front garden at that time, and behind some bushes, and had somewhat of a modest radial system, and worked out quite well, that inverted L at that time. Let me let it drop, and I'll say a couple of more words.
Comment on the vent.
Mel first, and then we'll pick up John after that. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, but for 80 meters right now, you know, I'm using a big loop antenna. That's my 75-meter antenna that I find very successful for the type of communications that I get together with my friends in, you know, north, south, or out west. So that works quite well. Not much of a DX antenna, the big 275-foot square loop, but... the antenna, my vertical, my full-size vertical on 80-meter CW portion of the band, that 65-foot-tall vertical with 100 radials, that is a really killer antenna as far as really working, if you're looking for working, really working the DX on 80 meters. That antenna, I really bring in things that have signals with the workstations, hundreds of DX stations, and a lot of people have accused me of making it up, but I've gotten the QSL cards in many cases to prove it. I have the last class. Okay, Dick, go ahead on. This is K2KEY.
John, you want to make a comment on vent pipes? I hope you're not taking that vent pipe away from us, John. For the guys who've got a steel vent pipe and you're allowed to make physical contact to it as a counterpoise, I think it can be great. But the PVC ones are going to be taking that away from us. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Dick, I just wanted to comment on the past 25 years they've been using NOHUB, which is not the old lead and oakum connections. So they're not as sturdy, and there is no conductivity between pipes because those connections are the rubber boots, as I'm sure you're aware of. Just wanted to remind you of that. So if they're going to mount anything structurally on that pipe, they've got to be careful and make sure it's the old type and not the new one.
Hey, it's good to know, John. Eric, tell us what you know about vent pipes on your new house. You got it, Eric.
Yeah, if you got a 3 or 4 inch vent pipe in most of the city, it's cast iron. And the cast iron, they actually connect the cast iron together with the lead, so you do wind it with a good electrical connection. The house that I'm working on in Plainview, which was built in the 50s, also uses cast iron. Well, the cast iron they use in the city is a lot heavier and a lot thicker, but again, they use lead to make the connection between the pipes, and it's usually a good electrical connection. It's necessary if you clean them, but they rust and they oxidize, so when you're making your connection to it, you want to take a wire brush and clean it up nice.
It's good to know, Eric. Eric, your signal is a little bit weak. You're 90% there, 10% noise, and your audio is a little bit low. You could talk a little bit louder. On that particular rig, is a little bit quiet. You may have heard the earlier question by Bernie, W02N. He's got a 2-horsepower, 3-phase, 208-volt motor running his air compressor. And how difficult is it for him to get enough inverter power, from your point of view, to run 2-horsepower, 3-phase? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, if you don't mind spending money, there's a company called MGE in California, and they make an inverter where you put in 110 or 220 single phase, and it'll make 30 amps of 3-phase power for you. I think it's around $1,500.
Okay, that's the Cadillac solution. And if I know Bernie, he didn't pay anywhere near that amount for the whole damn compressor. If he now wants the Volkswagen solution, do you have a solution there? Because you work with all kinds of solid-state inverters. What's the next one or two steps down for him, Eric? Go ahead.
Simplest solution, you can go on a surplus market. There's a number of places you can find it. Get yourself a Dynamotor. 110 volts on the primary side, 3-phase output on the secondary side. Done things are big and heavy, but they can be had for like $50 or $100 or $200. But yeah, you gotta look hard, but you can find them.
Yeah, various people have reported to us, Doug among others, W2SAY, that to use another rotary machine, another magnetic rotary machine, almost equal in size and weight to the original 2-horsepower motor, is kind of brute force, kind of a little bit kludgy and bulky. Among the purely electronic solutions, like a variable frequency generator or three-phase inverter.
Right.
Three-phase inverters, you know some inexpensive brand names there, Eric, KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Okay, 2 horsepower is about 1,400 watts, yes?
Right on the nose.
There are where you find them used. I mean, you could build that, actually, if you're into it, but it's not that hard. know also in the surplus market there are some smaller inverters that are designed specifically for that application. You can find them. You know, if you're going to go new, it's not going to come cheap. That's all I got to say. But they do exist.
One other thing, though, Eric, and that is when you're starting from a dead start, a rotary machine, 2-horsepower rotary machine, that inverter is starting off looking into a dead short circuit. Is an ordinary inverter without some kind of a helping starter circuit going to be able to handle that? Over to you, Eric.
Well, there's a company called Solar Basic, and they make some small inverters, but they're designed for machines. They're designed for motors, and they actually have a kickstart part of it that deals with the almost dead short at the starting of a motor. It's not like you'll get straight up into a three-phase device. There's a little bit of a startup delay, but they're designed to work that way, and they work. You know, if you buy them new, of course, then you buy them new, but you got to really hunt around and find them. You'll find, I guess the best thing you could do is go search around some elevator companies and poke around their trash and call them up and ask them if they got any old units that they've thrown out.
The Google in the Wikipedia variable frequency drive is a picture on the first page. You're going to see that.
Okay, variable frequency drive and Wikipedia on Google. Good combination. Okay, one way or another, Bernie's going to find multiple solutions. He'll be reporting back to us. Paul, what's going on in space these days? I hope that the astronauts did all of their walks. I saw a picture of 14 or 12 astronauts. I think it was 12 or 14 astronauts, and a quick picture that was flashed on the news this morning. I presume they've done their walks, and they've installed the alpha magnetic spectrometer, this thing that's going to be measuring these gamma ray bursts of super strong cosmic rays. This cosmic ray telescope has been bolted down, and have they turned it on, and did it smoke? WS2M, our space expert, K2RAW. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I saw it mounted to the structure, Bobbed, I think they call it the S1 structure, coming off roughly near the center, the starboard port, on these gigantic truss sections, and it's mapped there. And you know, you could tell it's facing away from the Earth, the down side of the space station. You know, it's like facing the Earth, and the top part is it's got this truss section going across, and it's on top of that, so looking up, so it's all bolted up. It looks real good. It's big. It's roughly about 10 by 14 feet, and I think about 12 feet high. So I looked into it. Originally, it had a cryogenic cool system for superconductivity for the magnets. Originally, when they designed it, the whole contraption weighed about 9,000 pounds. Now they raised it to about 16,000 pounds. They put in permanent magnets. They took the whole thing apart. It took them about half a year to do that and put it back together again without cryogenics, which is good because it will last to the end of the life of the space station, which is 2020. Drop it. And of course, you know, it'll extend the life of the space station beyond that. So it'll be up there right till the very end and until they do away with the space station. So it's good to see that completed, and they did a lot of other work, spacewalks today. They lubed up the one of these joints that needed that. These gigantic joints that turn the solar arrays. You know, you have four sets of solar arrays, two on port, two on the starboard side, and they rotate mechanically. They went out there and they greased the gear. The gear is like the size of a Volkswagen. So they did one half and went away from that, and then they did other work, topped up some of the ammonia systems that work to cool the space station. We drop it. And meanwhile, they rotated that whole solar array 180 degrees, and by the time they did that, it took a while. They went back and did the other half of the gear, re-greased that. Turned out to be like an 8-hour spacewalk for the things that they did do out there. They had to work on Dextra, that's a big gigantic robotic thing that's attached to a robotic arm that was moved over by Coleman, one of the woman astronauts on board. And they moved this whole thing right over to the EVA guys to do the work, and got that done. It all went well. By the way, when it was operating the robotic arm, her and the two people that she came up with are going back on Monday while the space station is still attached to the space shuttle. They're going back on a Soyuz spacecraft. So their time is up. It's been up there like 4 or 5 months. And they'll be leaving, so you're going from like, 12 people down to 9 people on Monday. And the space shuttle Endeavour will return. Well, it's a 16-day mission, so I guess they got another week or so. Drop it. So, I wanted to cover that. Also, you brought up Juno, the spacecraft last week that was in the AARP paper. And, I looked into that. They planned that many, many years ago. And they cut the funding on it, and then they brought it back. And now it's set to go, like you said, in August. But that'll be going up on a big Atlas rocket. It'll be going to Jupiter, Atlas V, will launch the thing, because it's a long way out. It's got these gigantic solar panels. It doesn't have the RTGs like the other spacecraft that have gone way out there. The RTGs are those, they have plutonium on board, is the radioisotope generators, thermal generators. And they've had them on everything, but not on this one. They're going to actually use solar panels, and each panel is like 60 feet long, three panels set at 120 degrees to the center of the spacecraft. Center of the spacecraft has got this big antenna, which will be pointing back to Earth and drop it. This is WS2N. So Juno will go up there in August. It'll take, 2015, I think, it's going to arrive. I forgot the date. Like a four-year flight to get there, a little longer. But when it goes into orbit, it's going to be a little different than the previous visitors to Jupiter. In the past, you've had Pioneer 10, 11, Voyager 1, Voyager 2. Even the Ulysses and Cassini have gone by. And they were all spacecraft that would just fly by and take pictures. And you've only had one that went into orbit, not lasted, about 5-6 years in orbit. Galileo kept having extended missions. This will be the second one to ever go into orbit around Jupiter. But again, different with the solar panels. Big solar panels, because of the inverse square law, you don't pick up much light out there. I think it's, 5 times the distance, so like 20, like maybe 25 times less bright than around by Earth. So they've got these gigantic panels that supply the power. Now, the panels have improved over the years, so they could do this. Years ago when they launched Galileo, they weren't as efficient. But this thing's going to be spinning. And the interesting thing about Juno it's going to go into a polar orbit where Galileo is, was, you know, in an equatorial orbit around a planet. Cassini is also in an equatorial path around Saturn. But this thing's, you know, going from pole to pole.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Repeater, timeout. Okay. It'll be a very highly elliptical flight around Jupiter from very close in, to Jupiter, you know, less than one diameter of the size of Jupiter, to about 8 to 9 times that distance from apogee to perigee. And with all that, you know, the 33 orbits that it's going to make, it'll completely map out that whole planet. It'll do gravitational things. You know, the idea is to find out how Jupiter was put together. Galileo couldn't confirm all that. They came back with more questions than answers. So they're going to do figure out the mass, how it's distributed in Jupiter using the radio waves, the Doppler effect, actually, as it orbits the planet. So we'll look forward to that in August when it gets there, 4 or 5 years from now. I just wanted to bring that up, Dick. And also, like, you know, another spacecraft that passed that planet years ago was New Horizon. And we haven't talked about that in a while, but, you know, that was launched, what, 5 years ago. It's over halfway there to where its destination is, which is Pluto. Drop it. New Horizon is, that thing also took pictures of Jupiter, and it had a gravity assist of that when it went past Jupiter a couple of years back. But, you know, this thing's on its way. I remember talking about this on the net when it was launched, and it's over, actually halfway to that planet. And the reason I bring that up is the cost of launching some of these spacecraft. Roughly, like this one is like $700 million. It's around the same for Juno. And if you break that down, there was a thing on the internet of what it costs per person. It comes out to about 20 cents per person. So how about that, Dick? And you talked about, before I turn it back to you, you mentioned Voyager in the beginning, and you were wondering, you know, how long it takes the radio waves to get there. If you send a command out to any one of the Voyagers, one or two, to hear back from it, it's 32 hours now. I mean, this thing, it's got a thing on the internet, when you go to the Voyager site, how many AU astronomical units, an AU being the average distance between Earth and Sun, this thing is 116 of them. So it's way out there. I think Pluto's like 39 or something. It's a 32-hour turnaround time, Dick. 16 hours in one direction. Back to you for any questions or anything. This is WS2N Space Report TechNet.
Wow. 116 astronomical units. In order for you to calibrate that, Pluto, I think, is 39 astronomical units on average. So we're talking about almost 3 times the distance to Pluto. And I think Voyager is essentially leaving the solar system. It's about to start seeing the galactic wind. It no longer sees the solar wind, which is about to stop. Got a couple of quick questions for you, Paul. What's the total power output of those solar arrays on the International Space Station? I think I remember something like 2,500 watts in that order. I know that the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer was put on the International Space Station, because it's one of the few things that can supply enough power to it. It needs a tremendous amount of computing power because it's gathering data at some fantastic rate that has to be, that data has to be pre-processed into a much more compact form before it's shipped down. And by the way, your own eyes do that. Each of the elements of your retina do a whole lot of processing before it sends the composite signal from a number of retina cells to the optic nerve. Your brain wouldn't be able to handle it all. But that gives you some of the funny optical illusion effects because of that processing. So I think it's around 2,500 watts. You'll correct me on that. Is the magnet on the alpha magnetic spectrometer, I now know it's made out of neodymium iron boron, these new super strong magnetic materials. Since that thing is almost 15,000 pounds, that possibly is the biggest neodymium magnet has ever been assembled. What a machine. And I also saw that the tiles on the International Space Station and the Space Shuttle show a little bit of damage that was viewed over the last couple of days. And I guess they've come to the conclusion that the tile damage is not at all threatening to the reentry. So 2,500 watts, correct me on that. Is it the biggest neodymium magnet? And should we know anything about the tiles? WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I know we talked about the power, total power. I don't know, I thought it was 2,000 per set. I don't know, I'll have to go on the internet and look that one up. Or actually, back in my old notes, I would have that. I got so much power, I don't know what to do with it now. I mean, they are running all these different modules and experiments and all. They have plenty of power. These things rotate every 90 minutes. You know, it takes 90 minutes for the spacecraft to go around the Earth. So the panels themselves rotate. And this way they keep them looking directly at the sun the whole time. Well, the space station does go, up to the dark side. But when it's facing there, I think it's like one third of the time that it's not in the sun. Tremendous amount of power. They don't know what to do with it. When the space shuttle goes up there, the space shuttle was designed initially, I think, for 12-day flights to the space station years ago. They ran all their own power off the shuttle using big fuel cells inside the shuttle with power everything. So what they do now is they hook up essentially jumper cables. You know, they plug into the space station, and we drop it, and they get another 3 or 4 days out of the deal. So that's why they have these extended missions. You remember they did have years ago 14, 15 day missions by shuttles when they had the space lab put into the cargo bay. The reason they had that is because they had another unit that mounted behind the space lab, which supplied extra power for the extra couple of days, but that wasn't the norm. But now they're able to do this on a regular basis. And I just wanted to mention the Voyager, they call it the Helios sheet. It's going under another name, but this is the common name that they use now. That's where the solar wind starts to hit the intergalactic region. So it slows down by hitting that. Particles, I mean, they're far and few between, but it's there. And right now, Voyagers, both of them, are taking measurements of the Helios sheet to find out where exactly it ends. They know, drop it. Know where the solar wind is going out there. What's happened is Voyagers picked up the solar wind. They always know how fast it was going out. It's slowing down. So every week, the spacecraft is making these slight adjustments, and they have the detector is able to tell not only how fast the solar wind is going, but from which direction it's coming from, and it looks like it's changing direction, coming off, it's essentially bouncing off of into galactic space and starting to come back. So it's the speed, as far as the spacecraft is concerned, the solar wind is almost down to zero, and now they're just trying to figure out which direction it's coming off. It's like putting your hand out, wetting the end of your finger and telling which way the wind is going. By the way, if you go to the Voyager site and you look at the astronomical units and how many billions of kilometers it is away from Earth, it's constantly changing because the Voyager is moving. Let me drop it. 40,000 miles per hour relative to the sun, so it's actually you see it ticking away. It's pretty cool to look at, in real time. It gives you a good layout of where it is and where it's been, and all kinds of videos, diagrams. Good sites to go to. Actually, all these spacecraft, you put the name of the spacecraft in, and you go to the NASA sites, and you get terrific amount of information of all these missions that are going on and the ones that are going to be going on in the future. So back to you, Dick. WS2N, SpaceNet.
Rather good, Paul. The 116 astronomical units to the Voyager, where one astronomical unit, distance between us and the sun, 93 million miles, you multiply that out, and you know that the speed of light is 186,000 miles per second, which turns out to be more exactly 670.6 million miles per hour. That's what the speed of light is. And you divide one and the other, and you realize that 116 astronomical units, the signal going out there one way, 16.08 hours, just like you said, 32 hours round trip. If you give Voyager a command, and you want to make sure the command is properly received, you give it the set of commands, and you tell it, record this into your memory, but don't do it. Then tell me what you've heard. So 32 hours later, you get the message back, and you look at it bit by bit and say, okay, you got it right, now go do it. Another 16 hours required. So you give it a command, verify the command, and then have it carry it out. You had quite a few days here at the speed of light. Isn't that amazing? One quick question for you, Paul. If Juno is going to make polar orbits around Jupiter, going really in orbit, making nice high-resolution pictures, why only 32 orbits? I'm pretty sure that's going to be extended on the assumption it's a successful mission. Why only 32? You got a rough guess as to how long those 32 orbits going to take? Is that a one-year period? WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, it takes 11 days. It'll take 11 days for one orbit. So 33 orbits gets you roughly about a year. And what they're going to do is, by doing what they're doing, pole to pole, they're going to take every part of that planet, and with their five different detectors on board, cameras included, they're going to have enough information for what they need. And as far as being extended, they won't need to extend it. It's designed to, cut this thing up like a pear, collect all the information from every part of that planet. I mean, the depth of the red spot, how deep the storm goes into the planet. Does the planet have a rocky core, which they believe it does, but how big is this rocky core? It's going to check on its dynamo effect. They know it has that. By having the highly elliptical orbit, they're going to be
doing all the magnetic, you know, it's got the biggest magnetic sphere out of all the planets. They'll be able to evaluate that in real detail. And toward the end of the mission, let me drop it. Not be an extended mission to this. That's it. Once they've got all the data, it's over. And they're going to deorbit it, and they're going to burn it up into the atmosphere of Jupiter. That's so it doesn't accidentally eventually wander someday into the future into one of the moons. They don't want to contaminate them. These spacecraft, some of them have not gone through the type of cleaning, sterilization that would be needed for, you know, let's say a robo landing, something that's going to land. Same was true for Galileo, and that's why it burnt up into the atmosphere. They did that on purpose. And they'll do the same with Cassini when it's done orbiting Saturn. So that's one of the things that with Juno. It's going to be a one-year project. That's it. All over. Done with. Once the data is in, they'll spend years evaluating that. Back to you.
So, heard somebody say Joe. I'm not quite sure what that means. Want to give us a longer transmission if it's on this subject?
This is K2UZO. Can I have two people in the queue, please?
Okay, K2UZO, you want to be on in the queue, and there are two people ahead of you right now. Rich, N2EO, and Larry, WA2OGA. Rich, N2, thank you, Paul, good stuff. And I know that mission's going to be extended a little bit, because they're going to make a discovery in all of those measurements that something is not going to be quite easy to understand, it's going to be extended. You wait and see. Prediction on my part. Rich, N2EO. Go right ahead with your question, K2RIW in the second hand.
Okay, good evening, Dick. K2RIW, TechNet Limelock, N2EO. Yeah, I got a more mundane radio question for you, Dick. I'm setting up on 1296. Everything is hooked up. Just we got to get the antenna up. And we're now QRV on 432 sideband. I remember a number of years ago, you were keeping a sked with K4CAW in Greensboro, North Carolina, nightly on 432. You would tell them how many dBE was out of the noise. I know you used the step attenuator, and I assume what you did was you brought the attenuator down until you couldn't hear the signal anymore, read off the dBs, and that told you how many dBs out of the noise he was. My question is, I assume you put that attenuator in the RF line, not in the IF between the receiving converter. Let me let it reset. The receiving converter and the receiver, and then I'll tell you something. Stand by. All right. You know, I own a WaveTech 3000B service monitor. I restored a Kenwood T599 transmitter and an R599 receiver. This is a Kenwood Twins from about 1975. And I'm using those with the transverters on 432 and 1296. Now, what I did was I calibrated the S-meter on 10 meters, which is the IF frequency, to 50 microvolts for an S9 reading, terminated 50 ohms into the WaveTech. Can I place the attenuator there? It would be a lot easier, of course, to do it at 28 megs than it would at 432 or 1296 to make the same types of measurements. Back to that, N2EO.
Yeah, Don, good question. And you realize that you have a simple-sounding question. When you dig into the particulars, it's a little bit more complicated than you'd like, Rich. Measuring signal-to-noise ratio at UHF frequencies and at HF frequencies, not quite as easy and direct as you think. Common sense would lead you to believe you put a step attenuator between the antenna and the radio, plug in 10 dB of attenuation, you think you've made the signal 10 dB weaker. Yes, you have made the signal 10 dB weaker. But on HF frequencies, the antenna is picking up a significant amount of space noise. I'm going to call it space noise. Ionospheric noise, literally noise from the outer galaxies and so on. All kinds of noise. In fact, my guess is on a good day, on 80 meters when the band is open, the total amount of noise coming into your receiver is about equivalent to the noise that would come from a 35 decibel noise figure preamplifier. There's a lot of noise coming into the outside from the outside world in many cases. So as you plug in 10 dB of attenuation between the antenna and your receiver on an HF frequency, you've made the signal 10 dB weaker. You've made the noise 10 dB weaker. Your step attenuator is not smart enough. Let me drop. It's not smart enough to know the difference between signal and noise. It attenuates everything. Your S meter will come down by 10 dB, but the signal and noise both got 10 dB weaker, and your signal to noise ratio didn't change one iota. So measuring signal to noise ratio is a little bit more complicated. And on top of that, let's assume now that you've got control of the guy that's transmitting the signal. He's on the other end of a phone line. And you tell him, press down the key, and you measure how much dB of S meter deflection you get. And you tell him, lift up the key, and you measure how much background noise you get. And you'd like to call that signal-to-noise ratio. Unfortunately, it's not. That signal plus noise-to-noise ratio, when he pressed down the key, you were getting the noise plus his signal. And when he lit up the key, you were getting only the noise. So it's signal plus noise-to-noise ratio. So even more complicated mathematics is required there to figure out what is the real signal-to-noise ratio. When you put the step attenuator in the IF strip, by the way, putting the RF attenuator, putting the step attenuator in front of the receiver is lowering the signal and lowering the noise. You get up to a UHF frequency like 432 or 1296. Let me drop. At those higher frequencies, Mother Nature noise is a lot weaker, but it's not zero. If you're running a state-of-the-art noise figure front end, you know, 0.7 dB noise figure on 432 or 1296, what percentage of the noise coming into your receiver is from your own low-noise amplifier, and what percent of it is coming from the outside world? As you plug in that step attenuator in between the antenna and the receiver, the one thing you can say for sure, every decibel of attenuation you plug in is raising the apparent noise figure of your total receiver system. If you had a 1 dB noise figure system, that's the noise figure of your low noise amplifier on the front end of your receiver, and you plugged in 10 dB of a step attenuation in front of that to the antenna, your total receiving system is now gone to very close to 11 decibel noise figure. I say very close because even that's a little bit more complicated, because a 1 decibel noise figure, low noise amplifier, is, electronically speaking, cryogenic. It is making the amount of noise of a 50-ohm resistor at roughly 77 degrees Kelvin, which is roughly 200 and some odd degrees below zero centigrade. Electronically, it is cryogenic, and you're taking this hot room temperature thing at 290 degrees Kelvin, your step attenuator, and plugging it in front. So if you want to be a good scientist, the math to figure out exactly what you've done, as you can tell, is a little bit more complicated. Now, when I was listening to K4CAW, let me drop. This started in roughly 1978-79, when I had so-called perfected these 19-element RIW insulated Yagis. And I put up an array of 16 of them. So this is a 3,500 cubic foot antenna. 16 feet wide, 15 feet high, 13 feet deep. 16 Yagis on 432 fastened to the top of a 100-foot tower. And in order to get it past the 12 guy wires, I had to assemble that antenna at the 100-foot level, a 3,500 cubic foot antenna. It was made in modules and hauled up one quarter at a time, and then assembled on site. So that antenna gave me something close to a megawatt of effective radiated power, single sideband on 432, and a good receiving system in the beginning. That's another story. So here's this guy, K4CAW, Greensboro, North Carolina, 480 airline miles from me. Great circle distance, 480 miles. He's 200 miles inland in Greensboro, North Carolina. And every Tuesday night from 7:30 to 8 o'clock, I had a schedule with him for four solid years. Because when we started this thing, we just couldn't believe that those kind of signals could be heard that far. We were averaging 80 or 90% copy on single sideband, summer, winter, spring, and fall. And you study the way propagation operates. I mean, my radio horizon is something like 50 miles, 45 miles away. This guy is 10 times further away than my radio horizon. That's real, you know, forward-propagated, tropospheric scatter, earth-bending type signals, scatter off of aircraft, all kinds of funny things are happening. And as I was saying, when I'm getting 80% copy with him, I was calling...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I called it 2 dB noise, a 2 dB signal-to-noise ratio, but it's a big catch. When he was talking to me on single sideband, during the times he's talking versus not talking, I saw the signal strength meter move approximately 2 decibels. That's not a very accurate measurement. Is that 2 dB of signal-to-noise ratio? Hell no. 2 dB of signal-to-noise ratio, or 1.5 dB signal-to-noise ratio, if that's really how far the signal was above the peaks of the noise, would I get 80% single sideband copy of his voice where I knew his vocabulary and roughly what he's about to say to me on each one of these? You know, I think we transmitted something like 3 minutes or 5 minutes in each direction. And we had a plan, you know, as to how the half hour went. We were recording signal strength and telling each other what we heard and the crazy characteristics on each one of our transmitting periods. And they were timed periods. So the signal strength meter kicked up by 1 or 2 dB. But is that what the real peaks of his voice was above that noise? Of course not. What really was it? I'm not sure. But it was a real threshold signal. The sad state of affairs is that after that four-year operation was over, I found out that the water that was crawling into the foam cables, the FM8 cables, all of the cables of the harness, the phasing harness of the power divider network that was feeding those 16 Yagis, they were absorbing water, which making their loss go up by an extra dB or so, as I remember, on each one of those cables, half a dB, dB. That, plus my noise figure in my low noise amplifier is nowhere near as good as it should have been. My total system noise figure, I think, was something in the vicinity of 4 decibels. It could have been a half a decibel if I had everything right, if I was using real hardline cable and the preamplifier was mounted topside instead of down the shack with me. So, if I'm talking 480 miles with 80% or 90%...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
80 or 90% speech reliability. If I really had a 3.5 dB better noise figure, what kind of range was really possible is a damn interesting question. Someday I got to go back and do that experiment. I've got the resources to do that. Real fun experiment. You can see the pictures of that antenna with me standing in the middle of it, this 3,500 cubic foot antenna, and you can see the computer-generated plot of those antenna patterns, three-dimensional computer-generated antenna plot. You can see all of that in the, I think it's the March issue, 2008, CQ Ham Radio. I think it's on page 32 or 34. Fascinating pictures. With one crazy guy standing on the tower at the 80-foot level. I took a self-portrait with the camera up in the antenna aimed down at me with the house in the background. Kind of fun picture. Maybe that's some of the information. As you can tell, what was my real signal-to-noise ratio? As you can tell, I've only got a vague idea what it was. But putting the step attenuator in front is far from as simple as you'd like it to be, Rich. N2EO, I wish the answer was easier. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very interesting. K2RIW, N2EO. Well, what is the validity of putting a step attenuator in the IF between the receiver and the converter? Does that do it? Am I proving anything doing that if I want to, say, make a sub-noise measurement or measure a signal and see how many dB it's hitting my I guess it would, that would tell me how many dB out of the noise is hitting the 10-meter receiver. For instance, like I said, I calibrated the S meter for 50 microvolts for S9. Now, I don't know how linear that meter is, but I can assume from my calibration that if something comes in S9, it's approximately hitting me with 50 microvolts of signal. And by the way, I seem to be doing all right. Let me go to reset.
Yeah, let me answer that much so before we go on.
Yeah, Dick.
When you have room temperature laboratory instrumentation, a signal generator, in front of a receiver, in that case and only that case, putting a step attenuator in front of the receiver is a thoroughly valid thing to do. You dial in 50 microvolts coming out of the signal generator, minus 100 and, wait a minute now, 1 microvolt is minus 107, you know what I mean. 50 microvolts coming out of the receiver, out of the signal generator, going through the step attenuator when it's set zero, and you plug that into the receiver, and you look at the S-meter deflection, and then if your signal generator doesn't have a variable attenuator that you trust, but you do trust your step attenuator, in a room temperature environment, plugging an attenuation in front, thoroughly valid, and all those measurements mean something. Connected to an antenna, all hell breaks loose. The antenna, with rare exception, no antenna you and I use, is a 290 degree Kelvin room temperature environment thing electronically. It's anything but. Well, on 80 meters, that antenna probably is 50,000 degrees Kelvin. I'm not kidding. It's some huge number. And so funny things happen when you put a step attenuator there. When you put the step attenuator in the IF strip, sufficiently far downrange in the IF strip, now you're making a valid measurement of what happened in the front end. If, for instance, it's a radio telescope, and you get the radio telescope connected, pointed toward cold sky, and then you point it toward your favorite star, for instance, Cassiopeia A, Cygnus X. You point it toward the star. And now the total noise power out of the receiver increases. And on this great big meter at the far end, you can see the noise figure increase with a lot of integration factor to smooth out the needle so it doesn't dance all over the place. Then you plug in your IF attenuation to bring it back to the calibration point. And if you dialed in 1.35 dB to do that, you know that the total noise power coming into your radio telescope
repeater, timeout, cancel.
Now you know that the total noise power coming into your radio telescope did increase by 1.35 dB in my example, because you put in the attenuator downrange and you brought it back to the reference reading. But there's a catch. Even putting the step attenuator in the IF strip, the good news about that is that so far downrange, it is not changing the noise figure of the front end, and that's valid. You don't want to change it. But even putting it downrange, you have to make sure that the signal source going into the step attenuator from the IF strip is a 50-ohm source, and the load on the far end of the step attenuator in the IF strip is a 50-ohm load. If not, as you plug in, let's assume now that the transistor driving the step attenuator happens to have a source impedance of 10 ohms, and the stage that the step attenuator is driving happens to have a source impedance of 150 ohms, and you plug in, go from 0 to 10 dB of attenuation, you didn't increase the attenuation by 10 dB. It's some other crazy number, because you're introducing an impedance matching device simultaneous to doing what you think is attenuating. So even there, you've got to be careful. But real radio astronomy-like measurements are always done with a step attenuator downrange, so you're not changing the front-end noise figure. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. Yeah, you answered the question. That's what was confusing me, because I know if you put the attenuator in the front end, you will be affecting the noise figure. All right, very good. So I guess it would be valid to put a step attenuator. If I, what you're saying is I have to make sure that the source and load impedance before the attenuator is 50 ohms. I guess one way to do that is if I have enough IF gain to throw away, I can put some fixed 3 dB pads on the input of the attenuator and on the output of the attenuator, and then slip in dBs as I need it to to make the measurements, so the reference point would be down 60, you know what I'm saying, down 60 feet, the isolation of two pads. All right, well, I seem to be doing very well, Dick. I'm able to hear the beacon in Philadelphia from W83CCX, the Packrats beacon, 24/7 on 432-288. Generally, in the morning, they're generally coming in about S8, S9, and with morning propagation, and dip down a little bit at night, but they're nice and solid on 432. And I'm hoping for the same results on 1296. Everything is here. I got the transverter hooked up, waiting for the, got to put the 35 element Yagi together, and all we have to wait for is the 0.9 dB preamp from SSB, which is going to go up on the in Germany, going up on the tower. Back to that, and to Leo.
Hey, wait, you're talking about putting a fixed attenuator between the driving stage of the IF strip and your step attenuator and so on. You've got the right idea. You understand the principle. Now, I'll tell you the next trick. As long as you never bring the step attenuator back to zero, you might not have to do that. If you've got enough gain in the IF strip that you can operate with 5 or 10 dB of step attenuation continuously in, and that's your reference reading, and then you go with the step attenuator above that. If you could leave it at 10, and then you take a reference reading, and then the reference goes up, and you dial in 6 more dB, and it comes right back to the reference point, and you've gone from 10 to 16, you know, it's a 6 decibel increase. Because you started off with 10 dB of attenuation, most of this impedance matching jazz I'm worrying about essentially goes away. So putting in those 6 pads, a poor man's way of doing that is starting off with the step attenuator already uprange. You see the principle. Okay, I hope we haven't put Larry to sleep. We kept him waiting an awful long time. WA2 Oboe Golf Alpha, I think it is, Larry. Go right ahead with your question. K2RAW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Okay, thank you, Dick. I was wondering if you'd forgotten me, but I figured I'd be patient there. I'm kind of new to setting up stations, and I may be asking some elementary questions, but I just got a Yaesu 857D with the screwdriver antenna that goes with it, and I was wanted to see if I could set it up as a portable operation, putting the antenna on a tripod, but I wasn't sure how it works setting up a counterpoise, what kind of lengths of wire, etc. I was wondering if somebody could give me a little primer on what I need to do for that.
Yeah, don't worry about the question being too elementary, Larry. One of the things we brag about, Mel and I, is that no question is too dumb. That's an elitist attitude when people say that, in my opinion. In other words, when a person is asking what somebody judges as a neophyte or dumb question, it really represents the biggest difference between what he knows and what he wants to know. So he's more deserving of the answer than a guy that's asking a sophisticated question in some cases. Screwdriver antenna on an automobile. Beautiful thing. Let me drop. There, that great big chunk of sheet metal that you call your car, your automobile, is a fairly good counterpoise. And the bottom of that sheet metal, all sitting a couple of feet above the ground, has got a pretty good capacitive coupling into earth. Now, when you take that screwdriver antenna and put it on a simple tripod with nothing else connected to it, what you're going to end up doing is making the coax cable quite hot. The outside, the beautiful RF signal crawling down the center of your coaxial cable, your transmission line, hits the antenna, and because the antenna itself, every antenna needs a counterpoise. In the case of a dipole, the other half of the dipole is a counterpoise. Your transmitter is pushing electrons. Your transmission line tries to act like, if it's doing the job just right, and if you're feeding a dipole, for instance, the transmission line tries to convince the antenna that your transmitter is a 1 cubic inch device hanging at the end of the transmission line, right at the center insulator. and on the first half cycle of the RF wave, it's grabbing some electrons from the left-hand side of the dipole and shoving them over to the right-hand side of the dipole. On the second half of that RF wave, it's doing the opposite, grabbing them from the right-hand side, shoving them to the left-hand side. So with a thoroughly symmetric